to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. This is episode number 807, I believe. I'm not in Libertyville, Illinois. I'm still in Illinois, though sometimes we forget where we are. But we are at an OPC General Assembly down in Palos Heights, Illinois, at Trinity Christian College. So for those watching the video, you'll see us in a different digs. I'm here with a good friend, Brian DeYoung, who serves as pastor of Grace OPC in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and was on the program not too long ago talking pastors in Wisconsin. We're going to talk about another one today.
Yep.
Welcome to the program, Brian.
Well,
it's great to have you.
Thank you. I was out on a fishing trip recently with some guys from another church, and one of them looked at me and said, "Do I know you?" And I thought, "No, I'm not. I don't think so." He said, "Yeah, I recognize your voice. Were you on that Reform Forum podcast about Wisconsin Presbyterians?" I was like, "Yes, I was. That was me."
That's great. I love it. Brian and I took a moment out of the assembly just after a morning break. Neither of us are commissioners, so none of this is inappropriate. And we headed over to this arts building here on campus. And for people watching the video, you'll see us. We're kind of just in an entryway right next to the box office. So we are, I guess we are the box office attraction for the moment, doing a run and gun kind of bootleg podcast here from a reception area, box office area on the campus of Trinity Christian College. It's great to be here. We're glad to be here. And it's an exciting day. We're recording this, I believe, a week before it will be published, if everything goes well technologically, etc. Tomorrow night, I'll be heading out from the OPC assembly. We'll be worshiping at Hope OPC in Grays Lake on Sunday. Hopefully, we'll have several, I think 10 commissioners will be up visiting with us. But then Monday, I'll be driving down to Memphis to attend the PCA General Assembly. So it's going to be a busy couple weeks. But we have an opportunity today and to publish this on next Friday to talk about a brand new book that Brian has written and published. And we're holding in our hands for people watching the video.
Yes,
you can see Standing Against Tyranny, The Life and Legacy of Arthur Perkins. This is a substantial volume, just over 500 pages, including the appendices and other end matter. And today we're going to take a moment to talk about Arthur Perkins, a minister up in Merrill, Wisconsin, who's part of the founding of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Also a friend, a dear friend of J. Gresham Machen. We'll get into some of that because there's some Machen material in here, not just about Machen, but by Machen. And we'll explain what that means. And looking forward to explaining the life of Arthur Perkins and his significance for today. But Brian, I want to ask you if you've got any follow-up other than people you meet on boats that are interested in OPC history in Wisconsin. But yeah. I know you also have a Sunday school class going on in honor of Machen and his book.
Yeah.
Some things to mention.
We went through the series with Daryl Hart, the video series, which, according to several of our members, it started kind of slow, but it was really good.
Sure.
I think they had to get used to Daryl's just kind of laid back discussion.
Sure.
And yet, as the series went on, there was a great, great interest. And I think it really opened some eyes on Machen's life and his struggles. And then we deliberately went from watching that to studying Christianity and liberalism, you know, the centennial of that. And as part of that, you know, I love that book. I've loved that book for a long time. But I realized for many of our folks, it would go right past them if they didn't have some discussion questions.
Oh, sure.
So I began writing up discussion questions. We take about 8 to 10 pages per Sunday. And I put together a list of discussion questions for them to read and investigate in advance. So they get their questions for the next week on Sunday. They read the chapter, they do the questions, and then they come to the class ready to discuss. Mm-hmm. We've had our first session of that last Lord's Day, and the discussion was so lively. People were so engaged. Mm-hmm. And so I'm putting together all the discussion questions for all of the chapters. And my hope is that once I get that done, I'll self-publish a discussion question book, which will be available on Amazon. Because I started looking around. You know, I don't like to reinvent the wheel. And I just couldn't find discussion questions.
Right, right.
You know, I found a lot of material about the book, but there weren't questions that a class could use.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I'll do this and I'll make it available for other churches that might be interested. And for myself, even though I've read the book several times, I love the audiobook, I listen to that, those discussion questions have focused Machen for me in a way that's been really, really helpful. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that will be available sometime end of the summer.
Wow, that quickly.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, I applaud you in that, and it's important. You know, I've reread it a couple times myself. We're obviously on the podcast, we're doing these conversations chapter by chapter, and it's been helpful to me too.
Yeah.
I haven't been thinking of discussion questions, although I do think about interview questions, and they're not the same thing. But getting back into it, having any resources or helps where people might want to read the book and be guided and get them oriented to think about the issues is really useful. So that's great. Well, we'll have to let people know when that's available and make sure that we have links and everything available on the website for that. That's great. Appreciate it. So any follow-up, any further information or funny things that I'm curious, I'm fishing, but anything come of the recent research and reportage on the Wisconsin pastors? Or have you learned any new stories or connections as a result of that?
Well, I have been kind of revisiting some old research I did.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, been turning up some new information, some new resources. I love photographs. I majored in photography. Yeah. And I found a photograph of Moses Ordway.
Oh.
Taken in 1820. And so I copied it. I played around on Photoshop to make it look just a little bit better. And I put it up on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
And a friend of mine on Facebook linked a manuscript about the ministry to American Indians and missionary work that I had never seen before. And so I, of course, tracked that down, got a digital version of it. And it was really exciting because there's lots and lots of resources available.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a good number of them, but there's more out there. And my next kind of major project that I'm wanting to pursue is a history of Presbyterianism in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
which will have some chapters on some of the main figures like Cutting Marsh, Moses Ordway, Stephen Peet, but then get into some of the, you know, early OPC guys, John DeWard, Arthur Perkins, John Davies, his ministry with the Indians, and also trace the development of presbyteries in Wisconsin, because there's new school, old school stuff going on with the presbyteries. And that's an area which I'm aware of, but I don't have my hands on it. I certainly don't have my arms around it. And so I really want to pursue that and hopefully come out with the volume sometime in the next 3, 4, 5 years that will be more of a definitive history of Wisconsin Presbyterianism.
Yeah. So if people want a taste of that, just the episode we did previously on Presbyterianism in Wisconsin was fascinating. I enjoyed it a lot. Fun. And so we'll link to that in the episode description for people to follow up so that they can listen. And I could want to encourage you in those efforts. Mm-hmm. I was doing a little bit of Wisconsin history myself in the recent past, but just a couple weeks ago, we had the MTI class for OPC history. So I taught that in person just nearby in South Holland, went to First OPC. And I have a section in there where I focus on those three Wisconsin men that I focused on when we did the men's retreat up in Green Lake. And three very significant figures in OPC history, but more generally just in Presbyterian history when we're thinking about John DeWard, who was very significant in Cedar Grove in bringing that church in, to, well, bringing the people into a new church in the OPC. And also then Oscar Holkabor, familiar to your congregation in Sheboygan. And then finally, Arthur Perkins, our focus of conversation today, up in Merrill.
Yeah.
Tell us where Merrill is for people who might not know.
Yeah, and this will make sense to Wisconsin people. It's just north of Wausau.
Yeah.
So, you know,
like what, 80 miles from Green Bay? Or
yeah, you're in Green Bay, Green Bay Packers.
Yeah.
Let's not even go there.
We don't care for that.
And you head west across the state, and about midway, not quite midway, mm-hmm. you have Wausau, which is a fairly good-sized city. And then you go up about 30 minutes, and you got Merrill right there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of north-central, a little bit to the east of mm-hmm. central Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's nice. And it's not Merrill.
Yeah, and it's Merrill.
I was listening to a podcast, one of the hunting podcasts, and they mentioned Waukesha, Wisconsin.
Oh.
And they got lots of mail for the next episode.
Yeah, yeah. Wisconsin has many interesting place names.
Sure.
And one of the fun things, I did the index for the book,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, I'm just going to tag every time I mention a specific Wisconsin city.
Mm-hmm.
So in the index, there's this long list of Wisconsin towns mm-hmm. and cities. So
on my way up, I was going to moderate an ordination up in Zohar.
Oh, yeah.
And on the way up there, like, I knew it was a ways up there.
Yeah.
And people might not know, like, the northern Wisconsin is way up there.
Oh, yeah.
For the U.S.
Yeah.
And on my way there, I saw a sign that said, I think it said Wittenberg, like 300 miles or something. And I knew northern Wisconsin was far, but I didn't know we're that close to the birthplace of the Reformation. But
actually, Wittenberg, Wisconsin is the birthplace of some of the best bacon you will ever eat.
Now that sounds Swiss.
Nooski's bacon.
They got sausages, but Wisconsin Wittenbergers have bacon.
I plan trips so that I can come through Wittenberg
Nooski's.
And stop and get bacon at Nooski's.
Okay.
Yeah, it's so good.
And, you know, we have a friendly rivalry, but that border between Illinois and Wisconsin does mean something.
Yeah,
it mainly means something in sports worlds.
Yeah.
But you Wisconsin guys know how to eat.
Yeah.
I got one time a mutual friend of ours in the OPC. I went on a trip with him once, and we had a great time, and I wanted to say thank you. So I sent him a little gift basket, you know, various sausages and cheeses and all this stuff. And he said, you warmed this Wisconsin boy's heart. Well, I might hurt his heart. But
well, every fall there is a soup that we make that has smoked bratwurst and cheese and beer.
Yeah.
It's a really good soup.
How could it not be? That's great.
Yeah.
I can imagine that some homes up there have one of those stews where it's always on.
Yeah.
It just hangs over the fire and you just eat some. And after you eat some, you put something else in it and it just goes on and on and on all day long, every day. I love it. So tell us about Perkins. He's a significant figure and lots of correspondence with Machen. He had his run-ins with the presbytery. He was not in the independent board for foreign missions, but also had his own struggle with and issues with the denomination that led to him leaving and joining and becoming an OP minister eventually. But there's some history there we'll get into. But just let's start big picture about who Perkins is, because I don't think a lot of our listeners are necessarily going to know, even OPC people.
Yeah, yeah. He's mostly forgotten,
even
in OP circles. Mm. But he was one of the men whose appeal was heard at the Syracuse General Assembly. And that's DeWard and Machen and Buswell, I think. And Perkins is right there.
Mm.
And so his appeal of his conviction was denied by Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
And then he and his wife and some friends that were traveling with them went over to Philadelphia and were there for the convening meeting of the First General Assembly.
Presbyterian Constitution Covenant Union,
right.
Which became the OPC, PC of A, yes.
And he offered the opening prayer that morning.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, yeah. So Machen had a high regard for him.
Yeah.
And he participated in a very thoughtful way in that First General Assembly. And then at 3 a.m. on Monday morning, he jumps in the car with his six friends. They drive 1,100 miles to get back to Merrill in order for him to attend a specially called meeting of the Winnebago Presbytery in order for his censure to be finalized. Because with the appeal denied, he's now officially fully suspended.
Yeah.
So he makes the drive to be there at that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And at that meeting, they, of course, read their form and they do their acts. And he notices that they are not doing everything they're supposed to by their own book.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, they are failing to pray for him when they are supposed to pray for him. So he asks the moderator of the meeting to have a specific presbyter offer prayer for him at the conclusion of the action.
Mm-hmm.
And the specific person he asked for was his chief antagonist,
mm-hmm.
who had done more than anybody else to get him thrown out of the PCUSA.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it just shows the steely courage of the man, even though when he's being thrown out of the denomination, he's still saying, but you're supposed to follow your own rules, mm-hmm. and shouldn't you be praying for me?
Mm-hmm.
And so after kind of they've done their thing, he asks if he can read a statement, which he does, and it's renouncing the jurisdiction of the PCUSA. He essentially calls them apostate,
mm-hmm.
and he says, we've taken this step, we've submitted to everything, we've taken this step, and we are no longer wanting to be associated with you. Please remove my name from your role and give me a record of your action. And they complied. So then he's free, and he can be without any more harassment from his presbytery.
Mm-hmm.
So he became the convener and the first moderator of the Presbytery of Wisconsin. And the Presbytery of Wisconsin was the second presbytery formed after the founding of the OPC. The first presbytery was formed in Philadelphia because they needed a place to put ministers' credentials. So the second one, chronologically, was Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. He was the convener. They elected him moderator. He was also the chairman of the Home Missions Committee, and he was designated as the field secretary, which would be like an RHM,
mm-hmm.
in our
regional home missionary.
Home missionary. And my conviction is that he was also the first archivist of our presbytery because he kept so many documents, things like minutes of presbytery meetings, but he also would get his hands on documents he really shouldn't have had, but somehow he got them and he kept them. Like the Winnebago Presbytery Center.
Like Trump just got indicted today, so I'm wondering for these boxes of files he has. I don't know.
So the
Perkins is storing things he shouldn't have had.
The PCUSA sent a representative to the Merrill Church,
mm-hmm.
and said, let us explain what's happened here and why your pastor has been dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
So the guy who went there was another one of the antagonists, and he had handwritten notes. Somehow they ended up in Perkins' possession.
Okay.
How he got those. He wasn't at the meeting.
Yeah.
How he got those, I have no idea. Yeah. But he collected all this information. Yeah. It passed down to his daughter. She gave it to the PCA Church in Merrill, Bible Presbyterian Church. They gave it to the Presbyterian the PCA Historical Center in St. Louis. And all of those documents have made my research so much easier.
Yeah. I want to dive into the details to learn about Perkins' life and where he came from and all that, but I think it would be really intriguing and useful for people for us just to back up just a moment. You know, his appeal came to the General Assembly at Syracuse in 36. What is his great offense? I think that, how did he get in trouble with the presbytery to begin with? Because I think that might set the stage for a bunch of people and other things that are coming.
Well, the initial efforts to remove him were on the grounds that he was unfit to be the field secretary or the field director for home missions. And they thought he was not the man for the job. Well, that attempt failed, and he was actually kind of reaffirmed in that role. So then they had to look for another angle to go after him. And the angle they chose was the fact that he started the Crescent Lake Bible Camp in Rhinelander, near Rhinelander. Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful just there.
North of Merrill. And this was going to be a non-denominational camp for young people from the rural churches. And part of the reason for doing this was that the presbytery camps, which met in other places, Green Lake, for instance, they charged $10 per camper per week. And this is during the Depression. And for these small rural families, you know, farmers, they couldn't afford it. So Perkins and his friend said, we're going to have a camp that's going to charge $3.50 and bring some canned vegetables. So they started this. They incorporated under state of Wisconsin. It's all non-denominational. It's not connected in any way. And once the modernists in Winnebago got wind of this, they said, we can't let him do this.
Right.
Because they understood he was suspicious of their modernist teaching, and he was going to be preaching the gospel, not preaching the social gospel that they preached. So they basically had a presbytery meeting where they said, we are recommending, and they use that word recommending, that all supporters of the Crescent Lake Project cease and desist. Well, that motion was passed by the presbytery as a recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And four times in that motion, they used the language of recommendation. Well, according to these modernists, once it passed the presbytery, it became binding.
Mm.
So it's no longer a recommendation that you can do or not do. It is a requirement, and if you don't do what they require, you are in violation of the presbytery's will, and you're insubordinate.
Wow.
So there's sleight of hand here.
Yeah.
It's also interesting that the official minutes changed the language to make it much different from what actually happened at the meeting. Perkins, when he heard that there was concern about the camp, he said, look, if this is unbiblical, unpresbyterian, or unlawful, I will not continue in this. And they used this, they twisted it around. So they brought charges against him for basically starting a Bible camp mm-hmm. for young people. And they pursued it. They kept adding things to the case. And they then took him to trial. And they spent 2 weeks prosecuting him.
They were ostensibly, as far as I understand, and correct me and fill this out, but they were mainly upset because they had a rival camp. So the issue is here that, you know, if they didn't have another camp, no problem. No one would be necessarily that upset. But since he's got another camp and then people quit going to the camp run by the modernists, and they're not able to fund it, or they're not getting as much income or attention, but they shut him down. But did they not also instruct him or recommend or even command him then to support the other summer camp?
No, they didn't not, come so out this, and say that.
So it's a little different than the independent board, right? Yeah. Because they instructed everyone to shut the independent board down, the denomination did.
Yeah.
And then they were supposed to support the official work of foreign missions from the denomination, and they used that failing to do that as the impetus for charging them for their violating their ordination vows,
right?
Because they apparently weren't supporting the work of the church.
Yeah, the implication was you need to stop supporting your own camp, and you need to be a good presbyter and support the presbytery's efforts. Right. And he would not come out and say, you're teaching modernism, I won't support that. But he was very reluctant because he knew the theological problems undergirding that. Mm-hmm. But the real issue, and I think this is something which we're always attentive to, is the nature of church power.
Mm-hmm.
They were saying, you have to obey us because we are the church. And he's saying, wait a minute, my conscience is free, and I do not have to obey you unless you can show this is declarative.
Yeah.
And so the issue, and this is true with Machen and others as well, the issue of liberty of conscience is front and center in the whole process. And he's fighting for liberty of conscience against the tyranny of a church that says, you will do what we say, you will believe what we tell you to believe, and you won't speak ill of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the temerity to speak ill of it.
This is part of the issue, right? That Machen's whole argument with beginning the independent board wasn't that it was natively a Presbyterian thing to do. It's the fact that the church itself was not abiding by its own standards.
Yeah.
It was not abiding by the word of God, number one, but also wasn't even following its own confessions and catechisms. And therefore, it was necessary to have an independent board to do the commands of Scripture, which are to send out people to the whole world and evangelize, call people to repent in Christ and believe. So when he was placed on trial, his whole reason for what he did, he needs to present a case for why it's essential that he did this.
Yeah.
And they ruled all that out of order.
Yeah.
Because apparently you're not allowed to criticize the actions of the assembly. Yeah. They just said this is – basically, they kind of, in effect, said they were self-authenticating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and this is the difference between Machen's trial and Perkins' trial. Mm. Perkins' trial went the whole distance.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecution called witnesses. They did everything they wanted to do. The defense had their opportunity to call witnesses. The situation was deliberated. A verdict was reached, and a transcript was produced. So one of the great discoveries that I made in my studies was in the Presbyterian Historical Society in Philadelphia, the PCUSA archive. They have the complete transcript of Perkins' trial. And that includes an abridged transcript as well as a full transcript. And that document was so beneficial for just really understanding what went on here, what was being done, what was the prosecution up to, and how did the two sides, you know, spar back and forth.
When did you find that?
Oh, that was...
What was that day like?
Yeah, you know, it was... I contacted them not knowing whether they would even respond to my email.
Yeah.
And they came back and they said, yeah, we've searched and here's what we've got. And they showed it to me. And when I started digging in and realizing what it was, I was like, wow, this is it. This is what I want. And yet, this is right around COVID.
Oh, goodness.
And so the possibility of traveling from Wisconsin to Philadelphia and going in person was just absolutely out of the question. So,
I mean, that transcript might get COVID from you.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'll tell you another story about COVID stuff. But I found, through the help of the library at Westminster Seminary, I found a young lady who went to PHS and spent a day looking through the material. And she was sending me screenshots of everything that she was finding.
You had a bootlegger.
Yeah. And so then I actually got a
pirate
chance to go there a number of months later and had a very profitable time. They were very helpful. I really appreciated how useful and helpful they were.
That's good.
And then I went back another time after that, about a year later, when COVID and masking was in full swing. And I'm sorry, I did not like wearing a mask. It was bothersome to me, but okay, you have to wear a mask. So I'm wearing my mask and I kind of pull it down a little bit over my nose so I can actually breathe and I don't suffocate. And the librarian comes over to me and scolds me because I'm not wearing my mask correctly. And then I want to go back for one more visit. And they say, well, the denomination passed a rule. You have to be vaccinated to come into any of our facilities.
Wow.
And I said, I'm not vaccinated. Is there no way? No way.
Wow.
So I was barred because I wasn't vaccinated.
Wow.
So
now did they ever repeal that or is that just going on forever?
I haven't heard. I haven't heard.
Wow.
So
curious.
Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about Perkins and Machen. I know we're bouncing around, but I want to get the high points before the order of the day.
Yeah.
And we'll have to revisit this. Yeah. You'll have to come down for lunch again. We'll do that. We'll do a lengthier treatment. But one of the really, really exciting things here is not just information about the relationship between, and a narrative about the relationship between Machen and Perkins, but an appendix that includes all sorts of letters that the two wrote, both sides of them.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. And when did you first find out that they had correspondence?
That was another, you know, kind of wonderful moment. I had sent a note off. I think John Meether suggested I contact the Westminster Library, the Machen Archive there. So I sent a note to them and I said, hey, I'm doing some research on Arthur Perkins. Do you have anything in the archive between Perkins and Machen? And didn't hear back immediately. And then one day I got this email and said, yes, we found two folders full of letters.
Folders.
And one was from 1935. The other one was from 1936. And I said, how can I get those? And they said, we'll scan those and send those to you. So I got these links to these documents, these digital documents. And going through the letters between the two of them was just so eye-opening for Machen as well as for Perkins, because, you know, there's basically nothing on Perkins anywhere. There's quite a bit on Machen, obviously, but the interaction between the two of them is very sweet. They had a really sincere friendship. And then I thought, you know, this would be a great thing to publish as an appendix. And I asked him, you know, could I possibly do this? And they said, well, we don't normally do that, but we'll let you do that. I was like, yes, yes.
That's great.
So, you know, this provides some new material for Machen scholars where they can get a look at Machen's replies. The letters started at Perkins' initiative. He was kind of tracking on Machen's case, and he just wanted to encourage Machen. He knew what Machen was going through because he himself had gone through a lot of the same things. So he writes this introductory letter and says, you know, hey, I appreciate you and what you're going through, and I want to be supportive of you. And Machen replies with a really tender reply, and they start going back and forth. The just kindness and friendship that shines through those letters. Now, they had met one time at a fundraising dinner for Westminster Seminary. Perkins remembered it. Machen didn't. Of course, Machen's, you know, going all over the place.
Thousands of people, yeah.
And then they meet at the Syracuse Assembly, and they meet at the first GA of the OPC. And then they don't meet again until January 1, 1937 in heaven, because both of them had died at that point.
So soon.
But the amount of care for each other, the amount of admiration for each other. Now, you know, I've read a fair amount of Machen. I haven't read everything he said. But as I read Machen, he's not a flatterer. He's not someone who says things in a kind of flippant way. He expresses such strong admiration for Perkins and what Perkins is going through. And Perkins reciprocates. And you just have a sense of here's two friends bearing each other's burdens in love, fulfilling the law of Christ.
So a couple things here. Following the Perkins trial, it was a failed appeal, and I should say it was denied, and then coming into the OPC, the Presbyterian Church of America, so named at the time. Some even OPC people who know the OPC quite well will recognize that there is no OPC church in Merrill, Wisconsin. So what happened?
The Sunday after he renounced the jurisdiction of the PCUSA, they held services in the American Legion Hall, which is across the street from First Presbyterian in Merrill. It is not a quarter of a mile. It may not even be an eighth of a mile away from his old church. And the American Legion Hall had seating for probably 100 to 120. They had 100 people there. Almost all the elders, Sunday school teachers, everybody that was in leadership in the Merrill Church came to what became known as Community Presbyterian Church. Mm-hmm. So Community Presbyterian Church was the first church received into the Presbytery of Wisconsin in Upper Michigan. And they continued after his death for a short time, and then they left because he had been really the link to the OPC. They kind of wander in independency for a while, and then they join the Bible Presbyterians. The Bible Presbyterians say, we will let you join, I think this was Carl McIntyre, if you change the name of your church to Bible Presbyterian Church.
Masters of branding.
Yes. So they said, okay, we'll do that. And they were in the Bible Presbyterians for a time. And then due to some things in Bible Presbyterian circles, they left and they ended up in the PCA. But they are still known as Bible Presbyterian Church of Merrill,
wow,
which causes confusion, sure, because they're PCA.
As it would. It's like, so, all these, Christ Evangelical Presbyterian Church, yeah, that's PCA. Yeah, it's also, yeah, confusing.
So the Reverend Bob Smallman was there for a lot of years. Mm. And one of the missionaries that they supported was Joy Perkins, which was the youngest daughter of Arthur and Marie. And she worked for the Africa Inland Mission, I think it was. And she would come and report. She kept close connection. And she's the one that passed along the material to Bob Smallman, who then passed it to Wayne Sparkman down in St. Louis. Mm. And they are still a very vibrant, sound PCA church there in Merrill. So, you know, for the 80-plus years since their founding, they have been ministering in that community.
Yeah, praise the Lord.
Yeah.
Perkins, looking at the clock, I've got at least a seminary lunch to get, okay, to eventually. Yeah. We're going to do a chapter two for sure. But yeah. Perkins, as you mentioned, he re-met Machen when Machen passed away on January 1st, 1937. Yeah. Perkins had preceded him. So, you know, it's a sad story, but I think it's one that's important for us to talk about. I mean, yeah, it touches upon ministerial care, touches yeah, upon mental health and all sorts of other issues. But tell us about maybe Perkins' injury and yeah, then, you know, other things he was going through toward the end of his life.
Yeah, so he was keeping a bold face on things going into July of 1936. In July, they had their summer camps for the young people at Crescent Lake. And every year they took a group picture of all the campers with all the staff of the camp. And he and several other men were standing on a bench so that they were kind of at the top of the picture. And apparently the bench collapsed. He and the others fell off and he hit his head on a tree. There was a big knot on his head, but he didn't want to go to the hospital. He didn't want to see a doctor. You know, this is a man's man.
Yeah.
Right. He starts having these unexplained headaches, very severe headaches. And going into August, he's starting to show signs of what was called at the time a nervous breakdown.
Mm-hmm. Right.
His wife was trying to care for him. Friends were trying to care for him. But there was a downward slide that was underway, and they didn't know what to do. So in early October, some friends with his wife said, let's go on a road trip to Nebraska, visit some family in Nebraska, just get away. And so they went and they thought, well, this is good. He's liking this. This is helping him regain his equilibrium. But then he takes a severe downturn. They took him to a doctor of osteopathy.
Mm-hmm.
And this doctor of osteopathy said, traditional medicine isn't going to do you any good. You need to go to the osteopathic clinic in Macon, Missouri, still Hildreth Clinic, and you need to get care there. So they did. They went there, and he was checked in, and he spent almost 2 months there. And in the book, I relate some of the stuff that osteopathy was teaching at the time. It's some kind of weird stuff. And there's a feeling that we can fix any kind of mental or nervous disorder with, you know, basic chiropractic care or other alternative medical procedures. If we can get your body realigned, your mental problems will go away. Mm-hmm. But he was suffering what you might call spiritual depression.
Yeah, of course.
And he,
on top of a terrible concussion, and you name it.
He needed Christian fellowship.
Yeah.
But in this clinic, there's no Christian fellowship. His wife would come and visit him every other week, but that was not enough. He needed the body of Christ around him. And so he suffered, and he just kept declining. And she's having to pay, and they weren't rich people. She's having to pay for his care, and she's running out of money. So eventually, at the end of December 22, she feels she has no choice but to transfer him to the Mendota State Mental Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin. He goes there, and they do a complete examination. They diagnose a number of his problems, including a weak heart. He spends a week there, and he dies. Mm. And he just had lost his grip on life. And Marie wrote a letter to Edwin Ryan, who we know, who was actually quite helpful at that time. Mm. And she, one of the things she said is, we don't really understand what a toll this took on my husband. The whole trial, especially there was a point where he was being cross-examined by his chief antagonist, Olson, and Olson was harassing him in that cross-examination. Something broke inside of Arthur Perkins because of the trauma he went through. And then physically, his body just couldn't hold up. And so at age 49, he's dead. Goodness. And the last pictures that we have of him, he looks like he's 59, 69. He looks much older, very harried. And he just kind of loses his grip. But in God's providence, he goes to glory. He's with Christ. And then his friend shows up 3 days later. And the two of them really laid aside the struggles that they had gone through. And were at peace in the presence of Christ.
That's amazing. I've heard this story multiple times talking to you, researching it a little bit. I'm dying to get into and read, and I've been thumbing through the book and looking to get into the whole story and go back to earlier history. I've read some advanced chapters before. So excited about this, but how can people get a hold of this book? Because you've made it very easy for people to get.
Yes, we're
thankful for that.
Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Standing Against Tyranny. I chose to publish this through Amazon. There is a Kindle version, there is a paperback, and there is a hardback. And then if you're into audiobooks, there is an Audible audiobook version. And so this is something I just love about this on-demand publishing. You order it, and they send the order to their printer. 2 or 3 days later, it is sitting on your doorstep.
It shows up. Now, this is typeset really well. Maybe you can give your son some credit because a lot of times when you're looking at direct Kindle publishing, sometimes there leaves something to be desired. But this is a really nice title.
Yeah, I actually had two of my sons deeply involved in this project. One of my sons, my oldest son, Dr. Ian DeYoung, was one of the editors, and he gave me a lot of scholarly feedback in the early writing and editing process. And he was looking at the whole project from his vantage point as an English scholar, and he really stimulated me a lot. I needed him pushing me, so that was really good. When we got to the layout and design part of it, my son Cameron, who works for a design agency in Wisconsin and has done some freelancing work, he was my graphic designer, and he did all the layout. So he and I worked together for about 2.5-3 months pretty intensively. And I told Cam, I said, Cam, I want a beautiful book. I want a book that people will pick up and they will like how it looks and feels.
Yeah.
And I'm really satisfied.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, I have to mention the picture on the cover.
Yeah.
So this was the typical picture that was used for his publicity. It was his graduation picture from Moody in 1925. And I found black and white versions of it.
Oh.
So I scanned the black and white and sent it to a Brazilian artist named Marina Amaral. And she took it, and she is an outstanding artist at refurbishing old photographs. And she created this beautiful, beautiful version of this photograph. Now, if you get the Kindle, you get the most beautiful pictures in the Kindle version.
Yeah. Are they full color inside when you have them colored? Wow, that's great.
The print version,
you can see the pictures.
Nice.
They're all there, but it's
But if you really want the photographs, go to the Kindle version.
Yeah, or buy both.
Or buy both and get the audiobook. And then you can have your phone open, you can have your paperback and your hardcover open, and you can be listening all at the same time.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. This is a substantial work, Brian. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well,
this is a life achievement, but we hope we see much, much more from you. Excited about all the other materials that are coming out
One thing I might mention, our church website, graceopcsheboygan.com, we made a subpage on Arthur Perkins. Mm. And that not only has information on the book project, but we did a conference in August of 21 up at Crescent Lake where I did 7 lectures on Arthur Perkins, and I preached 4 of his sermons.
Yes.
And the videos from those, which are on our YouTube channel, are also available through our OPC, Grace OPC website.
Yeah.
And so if people want to get the videos, just search for Grace OPC Sheboygan and go to the Arthur Perkins page under events.
Yes.
And that's where you'll find the videos.
We can include direct links to those materials as well. But yes, appreciate that. We'll certainly have that available. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. That's exciting. There's so much available. And it's wonderful to see these, at least from our present vantage point, these hidden figures, but now coming to light.
Yeah.
And we're able to record these histories and share these stories with others so that we would learn how God has been caring for and been blessing his people in the past, so that we too might also learn how we can be faithful in our present day and follow after him. This is great. Well, thanks, Brian, for taking the time. Thanks for finding, coming and setting up with the box office with me.
Yeah.
And we've had a few visitors, and hopefully they're not too upset with us for being guerrilla podcasters. But we're about ready to pack up and head off to our typical, at OPCGA. We always have different seminary breakfasts and lunches and dinners, and there's one I need to get over to from Mid-America, so I'm thankful for that. But I do want to point people back to our website as well. Not only go to Grace OPC Sheboygan, you'll find links to that in the episode description, but head on over to reformedforum.org for information about upcoming events and anything else you need to get a hold of. We've got some more stuff coming in the future with our online community. Until then, you can send us an email if you have any questions or comments at mail@reformedforum.org. But stay tuned for more things to come, and we want to hear from you. And I look forward to seeing many of you at the General Assemblies. But by the time you hear me say that, it'll be too late. Anyway, we'll come back next year. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Central.